Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Kicking with Cure here on Full Press Radio, episode number 92. Happy to be back with you once again this week. I'm your host, Ricky Keeler. Hope you're having a great Labor Day weekend as you listen to the show on Labor Day. Hope you enjoyed all the college football this week. We will definitely get into the takeaways from the official start to the college football season and the way the sport came back. I found really interesting and, in a way, captivating. We're going to get into that a little bit later. We'll talk about the baseball pennant races. Labor Day is another checkpoint and where you evaluate where every team is. And there's still some real interesting pennant races. I'm going to give you a date that you need to look at as to when we can look at, okay, what is the actual cut line for some of these teams. We'll get into that later. The U.S. Open in full effect in New York, second week in action. A lot of upsets, a lot of dramatic finishes, a lot of controversies. We're going to get into that as well later. Patrick Cantlay wins the FedEx Cup. We're going to get into the golf, which was a little bit interesting. And we will get, in course, we did the AFC last week. We are going to start the show with the NFC. But I'm going to talk about, of course, what happened with the Patriots quarterback situation, which is something I didn't get to talk about last week to begin the show. Before your usual set of how you can follow me on Twitter, how you follow the show on Twitter, we're going to give you the rundown for this week. This week, again, we're going to preview the NFC, all that stuff, and then we'll preview Dallas, Tampa Bay a little bit here in this first block. And then on Friday, we're going to do week one word association. We're going to preview week two of college football season. So we're going to do two shows this week, and then we're going to get into a little bit of the baseball, not too much of it. But I kind of wanted to go into touching on one game in particular, and we'll mention it in our games to watch this week as well later in the show. But Saturday will be the tragic 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and we're going to maybe spend a segment kind of reflecting on what happened 20 years ago, because I was 8 years old then. So I understand it's a lot tough for me to reflect on as an 8-year-old, but there's some of you out there. But we will spend some time on that, and I kind of want to do two shows this week. So I want to remind you, you can follow me on Twitter, at RickNader555. It's at R-I-C-K, letter I, Nader like in Terminator, and 3 5s. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, at FP underscore coverage, at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You'll get your podcast. Just search Kicking with Keeler. Chances are you will find it. And be sure to leave a rating. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. Any questions you have. Any word association suggestions you have throughout the football season. If you have a word or phrase that describes your favorite team's game, please send it over. RickJKeeler@gmail.com or tweet it to me. I want you to be involved in our word association segments. They're interactive. They're for the listener, just like you. We'll try to bring on, as we usually have done over the last couple of years, guests. Either people who write here at FPC about their team to talk about the best matchup of the week. Maybe we'll bring on other football writers that are taking part in this interactive thing. You only hear it here on the show, and I really love that we've made that unique. I enjoy it. I know a lot of the guests they have on enjoy it. Remember to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It is free, as all of our articles, podcasts, live shows. Anything you're looking for, chances are that we have it. If you missed any part of the show or you just want to go back and listen to my voice again, the most recent episode of every podcast is on the app, so be sure to download it today. So let's talk about the Patriots. Obviously, I want to leave with this because I haven't discussed it. Mac Jones surprisingly wins the starting quarterback job, and I say surprisingly, even though I feel like with the Patriots, we should never really get surprised by anything with Bill Belichick, and we still do, it seems. I did not think that Bill Belichick would hand the reins over to a rookie quarterback. As good as Mac Jones was in the preseason, every drive the Patriots had with Jones, a quarterback, was with the end result was a touchdown or a field goal. And that speaks to the consistency Mac Jones brings to the table. Now, the Patriots mainly used him with the twos in preseason games, which is why I was kind of disappointed in that Giant game two Sundays ago, where they did not start him with the ones, even after having those joint practices where he was the ones, because Cam Newton missed practice due to COVID protocol. I want him to get that opportunity, but remember, Bill Belichick earlier in the offseason said, do not read into who is playing with who. Maybe we should have took that as the given rather than just say, oh, it's just Bill being Bill. But having Mac Jones a quarterback creates a different ceiling for the Patriots. Because Mac Jones knows how to get the ball down the field. He knows how to be accurate in the short to intermediate passing game, which is what Josh McDaniels and Bill Belichick need out of their quarterback. He comes from a system in Alabama where he understands the expectation and the pressures of playing for a big-time football organization like the Patriots are. So it makes too much sense. Now, I disagree. I know Rob Ninkovich said this week that Mac Jones has been teaching Cam Newton the playbook. I hate to disagree with a former linebacker, a good Patriot linebacker at that. I think Mac could look at and show Cam maybe some of the passing concepts, but it's tough to say that Cam had to be taught by a rookie. I feel bad for Cam Newton. I really do, because I do believe he tried very hard last season, had to deal with COVID. I'm sure he had some injuries that were flaring up, and that's been a problem over his career. But there were two things that did not work in Cam Newton's favor. One, not being vaccinated. It's your personal choice, and we've talked about this on the show before, but you sort of, as the potential starting quarterback, have a responsibility to your team, to where if you're a close contact and you're unvaccinated, you are out for an extended period of time. You could test negative, but you'd still be out. And if it happened the day of the game, remember, unvaccinated players get tested the day of the game. You basically have put your team in a bad spot. You might not have meant to do it, but you still did it. You still did it. And look, I like that the NFL at least said, you know what, with the variant going around and the breakthrough cases, vaccinated players do have to get tested more than once. I think that makes sense. But as the starting quarterback of an NFL team, you have a responsibility to the other players in your locker room. And while it is a personal decision, personal decisions do come with consequences sometimes. So I would understand any team hesitant to pick up Cam Newton. Like, for example, let's say the Washington football team, right? They want to go pick up Cam Newton in case Ryan Fitzpatrick has his typical Ryan Fitztragic moments, as I like to call them. But why would Ron Rivera, who is a cancer survivor and has been vehemently frustrated publicly with his team about the lack of a good amount of players being vaccinated, bringing an unvaccinated quarterback? Just didn't make any sense. As good as the fit might be, and as much as we all would like to see Cam Newton pair with Ron Rivera again, it wouldn't happen. The other thing that's not in Cam's favor, I don't think he wants to be a backup. Or the personality he has, which I think people love, and I do too. I think he's got a fun personality. You may not like his Comic Sans Instagram social media posts. You may not like the hats he wears or things like that, but that's what makes Cam Cam. That makes him a lot of fun. That makes it like people want to hang out with him. But he's not a backup quarterback. You can't have that much fun or have that personality as a backup quarterback. It's hard to do. So I think once Bill told Cam, you're not the quarterback, Mac Jones is, I wonder if Cam just said, no, then just release me. And the Patriots will likely have probably maybe Brian Hoyer as the backup. I know they picked up Garrett Gilbert on the practice squad, which is a good fit. Fun fact, and one of the Patriot writers had this, the last time Garrett Gilbert was on the practice squad, the Patriots won a Super Bowl. That was the Seattle Super Bowl. So there were a lot of factors that did not work in Cam's favor to stay on the roster. It was shocking to me they cut him to begin with. But the Patriots now have their future in place. And to me, as someone who has rooted for the Patriots the entire time, it's again, like last year, a new breath of excitement to see a rookie quarterback, somebody that you can have your future tied to for the next 5 to 10 years, and hopefully he has some element of success. The question is, what is that element of success? And to me, the expectation doesn't really change. I think the Patriots, as we talked about last week, are about a 9-10 win team competing for that last playoff spot with a team like Miami with a big game on Sunday against the Dolphins. The Colts, the Steelers, and the Broncos. They got those teams competing for those last couple spots because I think I think that the AFC West runner-up would get in, which would be the Chargers, and the AFC North runner-up, which is, in this case of my predictions, Cleveland, would get in, and that would then create one final playoff spot between those four teams. It's a fair expectation. I've seen 11-5, I've seen 11-6, I've seen 12-5. I'm like, that's not realistic to me for a rookie quarterback. And then you've got people like Dan Orlovsky last week who are comparing Mac Jones to Tom Brady. Mac Jones is not Tom Brady. I think the better comparison, if you want to go the Brady route, is what Tommy Curran wrote, who writes for NBC Sports Boston. Maybe Mac Jones is the 2001 version of Tom Brady. Just somebody you trust to not turn the football over, make the right decisions, rely on your ground game with Damian Harris and Ramondre Stevenson, James White and J.J. Taylor, and rely on your defense to force turnovers and help with field position. But without Stephon Gilmore the first 6 weeks being on the PUP list, and who knows what will be happening after that with the contract situation, with Gilmore wanting more money, that makes it a little bit harder for the defense to win games by themselves, which I think they can win a game or two that way. But to me, 10 wins, I think, is a fair expectation. 11 maybe is the ceiling. This team is not ready to win a Super Bowl, but it's definitely in a better direction now than what it would be with Cam Newton. I think Mac Jones is worth an extra win or two. But that's what makes, I think, Miami-New England Week 1 so interesting, in that those teams would be vying for a playoff spot. And big news out of Miami today, Adam Shaheen, the backup tight end, and Austin Jackson, left tackle, out on the COVID list. And Miami might not have their left tackle Week 1. And against the Patriot defense that did a really good job against Tua last season in the one meeting they played against them, even though Miami won the game, it might help New England big time. Any edge you can get, you take. So we'll talk about our five games to watch on Friday, but to me, Miami-New England's definitely one of them. Now, looking at the NFC, again, we'll go division by division, and then we'll give the NFC Championship pick and the Super Bowl pick. And we'll start the NFC. We'll start the NFC West, because we started with the West last week with the AFC. And to me, you look at the West, I've been doing a bunch of simulations, like when I go win-loss kind of thing. And every time I've done one, I've found that I have a tough time where not having all, where I don't end up with all four NFC West teams over 500. So I'll just predict it. All four NFC West teams are going to finish above 500. Arizona made some good additions, at least with J.J. Watt on the defensive line. I love the acquisition of Rondale Moore at wide receiver. James Conner should help Chase Edmonds in the ground game. To me, it all depends on what Kyler Murray does going forward with the vertical passing game. Because there are some games where Kyler Murray does great, some games where he's not so great. He's got to find that middle ground, too. And let's see if Cliff Kingsbury finds some more balance. For Seattle, mainly the offensive line, I want to see Russell Wilson get better protection, something Russell Wilson wanted earlier in the offseason, and what their defense looks like. Because their defense got taken to task a lot last season. I'm going to pick the Rams to win the division. I'm not as high on Matthew Stafford as a lot of people are. I think the playoffs is where we're going to really find out about Matt Stafford, because you could blame it being on the Lions, but Matt Stafford doesn't have playoff success. So you can't, to me, you can't really pick the Rams to win the Super Bowl and host the Super Bowl, essentially, when you don't know if Matt Stafford can actually win a playoff game. Maybe I'm being unfair to him. Maybe I've been unfair to him all summer, but I feel like a lot of people have overrated Matthew Stafford for what he is. And he's going to help this vertical passing game, but to me, the key for the Rams is more the ground game. Can they get balance with Daryl Henderson and Sony Michel? Because you could throw the ball over the yard you want, but eventually when you get to January, you've got to run the football, especially if the Rams are going on the road and playing in places like Green Bay and playing maybe in a place where I think they could end up playing later in the year, in a place in the Northeast, which I'll get into. Got to run the football. Niners are going to be really good regardless of who the quarterback is. Their schedule's easy. It sounds like there's no official announcement on the quarterback. You would think it would be Jimmy Garoppolo week one. Trey Lance, I'm sure, will get in at some point. They did that two-quarterback system we talked about on the last show. The Niners' defense is back. It's healthy. Nick Bosa is back. I saw they signed Josh Norman. It'll help their defense somewhat. The Niners are going to be fine. So to me, I'll go Rams, Seahawks, Niners, Cardinals, but I think all four teams are going to finish above 500. So I have the Rams in the playoffs, I have Seattle in the playoffs, and I believe I'm also going to pick San Francisco in the playoffs. So I'm going to have three teams out of the NFC West in the playoffs. In the South, it's simple. It's Tampa. Everybody's back. Everybody's vaccinated. There was an interview in the Tampa Bay Times that Tom Brady said he contracted COVID after the Super Bowl boat parade last year. But everybody's vaccinated, which is going to be a big boost to Tampa Bay. They won't have to have mass outbreaks where people miss time. And they got their whole continuity of players back. And when you now have Tom Brady's, essentially his best friend, Antonio Brown, for a full season to go with Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, this offense is scary. And it's hard to really pick games where Tampa Bay is going to lose. I don't think they're going to go 17-0, but I could see like three or four losses maybe. But Tampa's in really good shape. The Saints, the wild card's obviously Jameis Winston. Is he going to make mistakes? Is he going to throw a bunch of interceptions? Or is he going to say, you know what, let's give the ball to Alvin Kamara. Let's make smart decisions with the football. Especially without Michael Thomas for the first six weeks at least. Can Jameis make decisions and not panic and try to do too much? And with New Orleans having to play week one against the Packers in Jacksonville due to Hurricane Ida, and hopefully everybody's doing okay, both in New Orleans, the Gulf Coast, and in the Northeast. A lot of flooding here where I'm in Staten Island. People still recovering from that. But the Saints to me are going to be interesting, especially that first month of the season. We've got to find out what Jameis is. The Falcons, it's going to be fun to watch Kyle Pitts. Matt Ryan doesn't have Julio Jones anymore. I don't really think there's a high ceiling on Atlanta, even though Arthur Smith will get Kyle Pitts involved. He loves using the tight ends from his time with the Titans as the OC. And Carolina is going to be fun from a fantasy perspective, but what exactly is Sam Darnold? Can Sam Darnold get those weapons, DJ Moore, Robbie Anderson, Terrence Marshall Jr., Christian McCaffrey? I think Chuba Hubbard's going to have a good year as the backup running back. Can Sam Darnold get the ball to his playmakers and not turn it over, not take sacks? Because there's going to be a big pressure game for Darnold Sunday against the Jets, facing his former team, a team that basically Sam Darnold, a lot of people thought, underachieved with, even though I don't think he's solely at fault for the problems there in New York. Carolina's got definitely got some intriguing moves in the secondary. Jeremy Chinn, the rookie J.C. Horn. Carolina's got a good young defense. They're not there yet. So I'll go Tampa, New Orleans, Carolina, Atlanta. It's not that high in Atlanta. To the north, I love the Packers. And this is basically the easiest pick you can make on the planet other than Tampa Bay. Green Bay winning the north. Aaron Rodgers is on a mission. Yes, they've got issues in the offensive line with Bakhtiari out to begin the season. But they've got Aaron Jones and A.J. Dillon. They can figure it out in the ground game. And while Green Bay doesn't, they have Randall Cobb, at least I guess that counts as adding a receiver. But I still think Green Bay could have used another wideout or two. We'll see if the rookie Amari Rodgers helps to some degree with Valdez Scantling and Alan Lazard. Packers defense has always been good last couple of seasons. I think they'll be fine here as well. So give me Green Bay in the north. I like Minnesota to finish second, but barely. I'm just not that high in the Vikings this season. As much as I like Jefferson and Cook as the big offensive weapons, Mike Zimmer's always usually got a decent defense. I think they've got enough upside to finish second. The Bears are going to finish third, and hopefully we see Justin Fields sooner rather than later. Bears, obviously, their defense is going to win them a good portion of games, and we'll see what Fields can bring toward the latter portion of the season. And I got the Lions fourth, and I'm not going to hate on the Lions here, because I do think Jared Goff has something. I think what Jared Goff needs now is a sense of belief in him. It's kind of the NFC version of Carson Wentz, where basically Sean McVay has, in essence, blamed Jared Goff for all of the Rams underachieving over the last couple of seasons since the Super Bowl. I think Jared Goff, while he doesn't have a lot of weapons in Detroit, is probably looking for something to stick it to McVay on. Dan Campbell's got that good personality as a head coach where he might win you a game or two just because you want to run through a brick wall for the guy. So while the Lions are going to be bad, I think they're not going to be awful bad. They're going to be like a four-win team, five-win team. Detroit can find its way to sneak its way to a couple of wins. But I'll go Green Bay, Minnesota, Chicago, then Detroit. And the NFC East. I'm going to go the Eagles fourth. I think Jalen Hurts is going to make some plays with Devontae Smith. I just don't think Philly's quite there yet. I don't trust Nick Sirianni as the head coach. Philly's going to be much better in the next couple of years. They've got draft capital. They're going to be fine. But maybe they get involved in what if there is a Deshaun Watson trade later in the season, maybe they get involved in that. But I don't think quarterback is the problem in Philly. Jalen Hurts, I think, is going to be okay. He's going to make the plays that he needs to make. To me, it's more of a question of their defense, particularly in the secondary. So I'll go the Eagles fourth. I'm going to go the Giants third. I don't trust Daniel Jones. Daniel Jones has always had a problem holding on to the football. I think that'll be a problem here, and it's going to be great to see Saquon Barkley back. Ian Rapoport reported on Monday. It sounds like, albeit through test this week, that Saquon will play Sunday. That'll against Denver, which is a big game for the Giants, by the way. And even though they added Kenny Galladay, they added Kadarius Toney in the draft, to me, the question of the Giants is the offensive line. They've had problems improving that over the last couple of seasons. Yes, they spent a first-round pick and a high one on Andrew Thomas a couple of years ago. But the Giants' offensive line is still a work in progress. And until that changes, as good as their defense was last season with Patrick Graham as the defensive coordinator, I don't really know where they can go. So I'm going to go with the Giants at third. I'm going to go with Dallas second. I think Dak being back is going to help. We'll see if his shoulder gets him through the whole season. I would hope it would. And their offense is going to put up points. And I think their defense, as mediocre as it is not as bad as it was a year ago and it was awful at times. So Dallas to me is two. And I'm going to go Washington winning the East. I love their defense. It's mainly a pick on their defense with Chase Young, Montez Sweat. The defensive line is fantastic. And I like their offensive attack with Antonio Gibson, Terry McLaurin. I think Curtis Samuel, as he gets later in the season, is going to have more of an impact on this offense. We've seen what Logan Thomas could do with Alex Smith and Taylor Heineke. So why can't Logan Thomas have success with Ryan Fitzpatrick? So to me, you look at the football team, they're much more improved than they were a year ago when they barely won the division. So I'm going to go Washington, Dallas, Giants, Eagles. That's my pick in the East. So my seeds are going to be the Tampa's the one seed, the Packers the two seed. The Rams are the three seed. The football team is the four seed. My five seed is going to be the Seahawks. My six seed is going to be the 49ers. And my seven seed is going to be the Cowboys. I think they're going to figure it out to get that last playoff spot. I think you're going to get two teams in the NFC. I just think Dallas, even though New Orleans' defense is better than Dallas, I think Dallas' offense is better than New Orleans. And eventually, Jameis Winston's going to cost them more games than he is going to win them games. So Dallas me gets the 7th seed, which means I would have, basically put it this way, I'll give you my NFC Championship pick, and I'll give you the Super Bowl pick. In the NFC Championship, I have Washington beating Green Bay, which means I have Washington beating Tampa Bay in the divisional round. And I could go chalk easily, and I have a tough time thinking it won't be a rematch of last year's Super Bowl between the Chiefs and the Bucks. But the football team, I want you to keep this in mind when you look at their season this year. What wins in the playoffs? Defense and a balanced attack that can keep another offense off the field. Washington has Antonio Gibson that can keep an opposing offense off the field. And they have one of the better defensive lines in football that can create pressure and create havoc. So you might go, well, Ricky, what about the Packers and the Bucks? And I think they're both legitimate Super Bowl contenders, no doubt. I said I think Tampa's most likely going to get in anyway. But here's what's in Washington's favor. They have a game with the Packers this season, and they have a game with Tampa this season. If they don't win those games, we all know it's hard to beat a team twice. So the football team to get a chance to play both those teams potentially a second time and maybe twist some things around. Maybe Ryan Fitzpatrick's not the quarterback anymore. Maybe Ryan Fitzpatrick's actually found consistency, because I'm going to be honest, it's going to be tough to rely on Ryan Fitzpatrick to prove you right in a prediction. But outside of the quarterback, there's really not many issues with Washington. So I'm going to say the in Super Bowl 55, it will be the Chiefs, and it will be the Washington football team But I will obviously not be a sucker here. I will go with Super Bowl 56. And I will go with the Chiefs to beat the football team. Kansas City wins their second Super Bowl in 3 years. It's just hard to pick against Patrick Mahomes. And again, improving that offensive line, as long as that offensive line stays healthy, I don't really know if anybody can keep pace with them. So Kansas City versus Washington, Kansas City will win. So looking at week one, and we're going to talk about Thursday's game, because we won't get a chance to talk about it on Friday, except we'll recap it, is Dallas at Tampa Bay. And the big news for Dallas is Zach Martin, one of their best, if not their best offensive linemen, is out due to COVID-19. You have a Dallas secondary that's in shambles, essentially. You have an offensive line that now doesn't have their best player. You have Dak Prescott having not played one snap in the preseason. You have an offense trying to find that same similar chemistry. There is not much here that favors the Cowboys. If you're an NFL fan that wants to see a competitive game Thursday, I'm not so sure you're going to get it. This Bucs team is rejuvenated. This Bucs team is motivated. This team is out on a mission probably to repeat. I'm sure Brady's got that in their heads. They're fully healthy. We just talked about how their offense, I saw an article, Mike Evans believes this offense is more in sync than it was a year ago, and that's just scary for the rest of the league. That Tom Brady at age 44 is going to have another fantastic season. The line I believe I saw was 7.5. I don't like to make picks for gambling purposes, but for entertainment purposes, I like Tampa big. To me, barring things changing for the better, I don't know how Dallas hangs in this game for more than a half. To me, I just think Tampa's the much better football team. I think they're... what I'm interested to see, at least from a, I guess from a fantasy football perspective, but also a real life perspective for Tampa, is who takes over in the ground game throughout the season. Remember, they brought in Gio Bernard, who's going to be, I think, their James White, and how they balance Leonard Fournette and Ronald Jones is still interesting. That's maybe the only question mark you have for Tampa Bay. Everything else, I think you really love where this team is right now, and Dallas is just not where they're going to be later in the season. So with all the question marks around Dallas, give me Tampa to win this game. I really don't see it being as close. I think it could be close for a half, maybe into the third quarter. But I don't think Dallas' defense can stop Tampa's offense. We will recap this game on Friday. We will also do week one word association for the rest of the week's action. I'll give you my 5 games to watch for week one in the NFL. Glad to bring both those segments back. And we'll also... I want to ask you this. Tweet me at RickNator555. What is your flip the channel game of the week? What I mean by that is a game that you would only watch on the Red Zone channel. You will not on your DirecTV or whatever you watch your football games. Flip to that game unless it's for Red Zone and hoping your players score in fantasy. And I've looked around the schedule and I'm having a tough time finding a definitive flip your channel game of the week, which I guess is good for the NFL that you don't have that obvious matchup. But we'll debate some of them and maybe you'll give me a better idea. So coming up next, we will look back at week one in college football, the big takeaways and why the ACC let down its best chance at the playoff. You're listening to King with Cure here on Full Press Radio. We'll be right back after this. Getting set to talk college football here in our second segment. I'm kicking with Cure this week for episode 92. Ricky Cure back with you again. And I want to remind you, of course, we are looking for different people to cover the NFL this season for us here at Full Press Coverage. So just go to fullpresscoverage.com. You'll find the writing application on the website. We're looking forward to hearing from you. And if you see something that's not on the site, a team that we're not covering, a league, different things that you see that maybe you would like to be a part of, you can always apply for that as well. And of course, we want to remind you about our FPC Live Radio lineup every weekday. It is FPC Radio Live every weekday at 8:30 a.m., especially during football season. That's when you want to hear your Monday morning takeaways from Sunday's games. Be sure to check that out, as well as Dylan Ross Saving Sports. And, of course, they'll have the afternoon reaction during the week as well. So both great shows here on the network. Get into college football. And to me, what stood out this week, fans were back, stadiums were packed, and you can have the opinion of super spreaders, and I think you're okay with having that, but you understand also that schools have had requirements on vaccinations for students. And to me, it just, there's some of those moments that brought great enthusiasm and chills when you're watching, where there was Virginia Tech and the kids doing the Understandman stuff before the game against North Carolina, where there was the fans of Camp Randall for Wisconsin doing jump around. You're seeing Gus Johnson get involved, and you're seeing like the announcers enjoying it. When you're seeing, you'll see, I'm sure, on Saturday when Ohio State plays Oregon, the scripting of the Ohio with 100,000 people in the stands, 100,000 people in Michigan in the Big House. Like, that's what college football is about. It's about the fan excitement. It's about the great pageantry of the sport and why we all enjoy it so much. So for college football, was a great first week back. And there were some good storylines and some interesting takeaways. But I think, to me, the biggest takeaway from college football this week, the ACC is in trouble. And it started with the Georgia-Clemson. It doesn't start with the Georgia-Clemson game, but that's really where Clemson, who's the prohibitive favorite to win the ACC, is kind of in a rough spot to make the playoff now. The Georgia-Clemson game that, honestly, I thought we'd seen a lot more offense with JT Daniels, who had a good run at the end of last season for Georgia, and then DJ Uiagalelei for Clemson. But Georgia's defense was fantastic in this game. They sacked Uiagalelei 7 times. Clemson's offensive line was terrible, but I think largely that was a factor to Georgia's defensive line making plays. And they were able to use that defensive line. They got the pick six that they needed, which was ultimately the only touchdown in the game. Georgia ran the ball 31 times, 121 yards, only about under 4 yards a carry. But Clemson only ran for 1/10 of a yard per carry. And so Georgia's defense, definitely the storyline in this game. We know their defense is going to be good. Now, they're going to need a lot more from Daniels, especially when they play at Auburn in October, then the Florida game, and then potentially an SEC championship game in Alabama. Definitely against Alabama, which we're going to get into in a little bit. But for Georgia, they put themselves in a good driver's seat where they have a win over Clemson. As long as they can run the table the rest of the way, even a loss to Alabama in the SEC championship game, as long as they don't get the doors blown off of them, Georgia's in a really good position to potentially make the playoff. So a huge statement win for Georgia this week, and Kirby Smart's defense, the main reason why. Now you look at Clemson. Normally with Dabo Swinney, you would say one loss doesn't define you being out of the playoff, and I don't disagree with that. I think Clemson's still alive. Here's their issue. They don't play one team the rest of the way that is ranked right now. That could change. Maybe NC State plays well. Maybe Boston College plays well and gets ranked. We saw Florida State, even though they lost Notre Dame Sunday night, showed good fighting against the Fighting Irish. And a great comeback story with Mackenzie Milton getting a chance to play. But Florida State should be improved. But still no ranked team in the schedule. You look at potentially the ACC championship game. Well, North Carolina did not look good against Virginia Tech. 3 interceptions from Sam Howell. Virginia Tech won that game in a hostile environment in Lane Stadium. Huge win for Justin Fuente and the Hokies. So it takes North Carolina potentially out of the mix. Miami and De'Aaron King. Chance to make a statement against Alabama? Well, Bryce Young showed I can plug anybody at quarterback at Alabama and still be really good. Bryce Young threw for 344 and 4 touchdowns. Alabama got out to a huge lead right out of the gate. They took a 27-3 lead into the locker room. De'Aaron King with 2 interceptions. Alabama right now looks to be definitively the best team in college football. But for the ACC in particular, Miami losing hurts. Duke lost to Charlotte. Georgia Tech lost to Northern Illinois. ACC had a bad, bad weekend. So you can't now look at Clemson if they're one loss and the ACC champion. Will that hold weight against maybe another conference as a one loss champion? Because Clemson, while you can say, yeah, their one loss would be to Georgia, they were terrible. Scored 3 points. I don't think that justifies, yeah, your one loss is to a top 5 team, but you didn't score. So Clemson's in trouble. And we've been used to seeing Clemson in the playoff for so many years. I think it's 6 straight years. That streak definitely in jeopardy. Now the ACC kind of gets hurt by the Pac-12. The Pac-12 didn't have a great weekend either. It got saved, honestly, by UCLA. And UCLA has been fun to watch. We have Dorian Thompson-Robinson, the quarterback, 3 touchdowns, 1 interception. Zach Charbonnet, who's the transfer running back from Michigan, ran for over 100 yards. And UCLA putting up 38 points on LSU. That was really impressive at the Rose Bowl. So the Bruins, who a lot of people have liked as that surprise team, maybe Chip Kelly starting to figure it out as the coach there. But UCLA saved the Pac-12's bacon this week, because I'll run you through the Pac-12 this week. Stanford got the doors blown off them by Kansas State. Oregon maybe looked ahead to Ohio State, although their best pass rusher and maybe the number one pick in next year's draft, Kayvon Thibodeau, got hurt. We'll see if hopefully he's healthy for Ohio State this weekend. But Oregon barely snuck by Fresno State, had to score a touchdown with 3 minutes to go. Oregon State lost to Purdue. Washington loses to Montana, an FCS school at home. So all the talk about the Huskies potentially being a surprise, that's out the window. Cal loses to Nevada and Carson Strong, who a lot of people like as a quarterback. Arizona loses to BYU. Washington State loses to Utah State. So we talk about this alliance. Well, 2/3 of that alliance had awful week ones. And they weren't, and the, while the Pac-12 school beat the SEC school in the low matchup that we saw, the alliance for 1 week doesn't define an alliance, but not a good start necessarily. We talked about Notre Dame beating Florida State. Now, I think Brian Kelly did not handle the criticism of his failed joke about the team needing to be executed very well. Tried to play off the old John McKay quote from the Bucks, and I thought Kelly was really too criticizing the media afterwards. If he had just said, look, I don't understand that people didn't view it as a joke. If they don't, I apologize. What I meant was this. There was a way to say it, but Brian Kelly just ended up being ticked off to everybody because people didn't understand his humor. But from an on-field perspective, what was really intriguing to me about Notre Dame, their defense wasn't any good, and we'll see if that improves. But Jack Cohn looked like a downfield quarterback. Threw for 366, 4 touchdowns, interception. Now, it helps when you've got a guy at Notre Dame, a tight end, Michael Mayer, who looks like a Notre Dame version of Rob Gronkowski. And some, at times, tough to cover. But for Cone, we were used to being, it was Kasim at Wisconsin, just managing the game and trying not to turn the football over. We're seeing him at Notre Dame, at least for one game, getting the ball down the field, being aggressive, making great plays about 20, 30 yards down the field. That's going to make Notre Dame that extra weapon of dynamics on offense, because they don't have to rely on Kyron Williams, who didn't run the ball very well. He had a good second effort touchdown on like a screen pass. But Notre Dame can be both dominant in the ground and passing game. Their schedule gets really tough in October, but considering playing at Doak Campbell Stadium, it's first game at Florida State since the passing of Bobby Bowden, that was a great win for Notre Dame, and one that you're lucky to get out there with a win. Another team lucky to get out with a win was Oklahoma. Now, credit to the Sooners for making that game as close to a home for Tulane as possible. They put their logo on the field in Norman. Obviously, Tulane not being able to play in New Orleans due to Hurricane Ida. But Tulane, I thought, came out with a good effort. They got a couple interceptions on Spencer Rattler. Tulane got out to an early lead. 3 touchdowns from Pratt, their quarterback. He also ran for one. The problem for Tulane, they had too many turnovers, drop passes that cost them drives early in the game. And Oklahoma eventually found some rhythm on offense. This isn't that surprising, though, because we've seen Oklahoma just have bad September games. Sometimes, though, those end in losses. For Oklahoma, for it not to end in a loss, you'll take it. Rattler went 30 for 39 for 304, but 2 of those 9 incompletions were interceptions. So Sooners will be better. I think people were shocked to give up 35 to Tulane, but I think it's more the Green Wave playing a really good game. The other Big 12 team that had its fair share of issues was Iowa State, barely beating Northern Iowa, 16-10. And you can chalk that up to Iowa State maybe looking ahead to Iowa this week. And that's a huge game for the Cy-Hawk Trophy and a big game for both those teams. We're going to get into that later this week. So Iowa State's a team to keep an eye on. The Big Ten, of course, had their fair share of conference games this week. It started Thursday night, Ohio State getting by Minnesota. Big loss for Minnesota in this game with Mo Ibrahim, the running back that had 30 carries for 163 yards and 2 touchdowns. He gets a season-ending leg injury, crushing news for PGA Flex team that fought really hard. And I was actually disappointed. Tanner Morgan, I thought, should have been better than what he was. But for Ohio State in the second half, C.J. Stroud just was able to complete passes downfield, and Ohio State made big play after big play. Here's their touchdowns in the game. And it started first play, first quarter, 71-yard touchdown run by Mion Williams. Third quarter, 38-yard touchdown to Chris Olave. 56-yard touchdown to Garrett Wilson. A 32-yard fumble return for a score. A 70-yard touchdown to Trevion Henderson. And a 61-yard touchdown to Chris Olave. Minnesota was awful defending the big plays. You could also contribute that to great play calling by Ryan Day. C.J. Stroud looked more comfortable in the second half in his first start, threw for 294 and four touchdowns. But Ohio State's not going to get away with that and allow 31 points to a Minnesota team that is improved. Ohio State's defense has big questions. Can they answer some of those against Oregon? Yes. But Ohio State didn't play a complete game that first game, but at Minnesota, get out of there with a win, you'll take it. To me, one of the more impressive performances of the week is Iowa. Iowa's playing an Indiana team that's off good momentum from a year ago. They get their quarterback, Michael Penix Jr., back. And I thought Iowa did a really good job with two interceptions for touchdowns for Riley Moss. They ran the ball well. Goodson had 99 yards and a touchdown, and it's tough to win at Kinnick Stadium. I mean, for some reason, Iowa has that really good home field advantage that really goes underrated unless you're talking about in the Midwest. But Iowa making a big statement. Penn State, in a game that set the sport back about 25 years, considering it was scoreless at the half. Penn State won 16-10. I would like to see Sean Clifford be more accurate with the deep ball, but he did convert on one to Jahan Dotson for a touchdown in the third. Wisconsin made some mistakes late in the game. And while Penn State's still, again, a work in progress, they do have Noah Kane back in the backfield. And that's a good road win for James Franklin and the Nittany Lions, especially when they come on a stretch where three of the next 4 or 5 weeks, they play Penn State, they play Auburn, Indiana, and Iowa. So the schedule's going to get a lot tougher for Penn State before it gets easier, but that's a big road win to get, especially at Wisconsin. The other team that made a good statement was Texas. I picked Louisiana to win this game because I really didn't trust the Longhorns. And while I don't think Texas is back, considering they had a new quarterback in Hudson Carter, threw for two touchdowns, and Texas really was a control of this game from the get-go. They win it 38-18, so good first win for Steve Sarkisian. Now Texas goes to Arkansas on Saturday, and Texas really does not play a ranked opponent now until Oklahoma. The Red River rivalry on October 9th. So Texas is in a good position. I think I liked that they didn't look ahead. They didn't overlook Louisiana, especially since Louisiana beat Iowa State last year. So Longhorns playing a complete game from start to finish, I thought, really stood out to me. And then you have one more game tonight in Atlanta, the Chick-fil-A Classic, Louisville against Ole Miss. No Lane Kiffin coaching for Ole Miss. He tested positive for COVID-19. So we'll see what happens with the Rebels tonight. But I'm a big fan of Matt Corral, their quarterback, and a chance for the SEC again to stick it to the ACC. I mean, you think about the pressure on Louisville to really salvage something for the ACC this week. The only wins race for the ACC teams not in conference play, NC State beat South Florida, Wake Forest beat Old Dominion, Boston College shut out Colgate, Pittsburgh beat UMass, Virginia shut out William & Mary, Syracuse beat Ohio. Not exactly good news for the ACC. Now, they can make up for it. Maybe not to the extent. You look at week two really quickly, and we'll do more of that next week. Virginia gets Illinois. Pittsburgh gets Tennessee. Syracuse gets Rutgers. But NC State goes to Mississippi State, who had to rally from 20 down to beat Louisiana Tech. So there's no ranked versus ranked where the ACC can make up for it in week two, but you're going to have to find a way to at least salvage something, because the ACC, you could argue, knocked itself out of the running in 1 week. A lot of football to be played, but not exactly how you want to start your week. The other news involving the Big 12, potentially 4 new schools joining the Big 12. It sounds like, from all accounts, I know that Brett McMurphy had it first, that the Big 12 is going to extend invitations to 4 different schools. So we talked about with the Big 12 contract before expanded. It sounds more like it's going to be expanding. BYU, Cincinnati, Houston, and UCF are the four schools the Big 12 is looking at. They could extend invites to them, and especially if OU and Texas leave before 2025. That's not a bad option. I like BYU joining a power conference because I think they've been one of those teams we saw last year at Zach Wilson that they can compete with anybody, and we saw they beat Arizona week one. They're a fun team to watch. Cincinnati, program on the rise as well, and having Gus Malzahn in the Big 12 is going to be huge. I loved what UCF did against Boise State, rallying because really the Golden Knights shot themselves in the foot. A pick six off the arm of Dylan Gabriel early in that game. There was some terrible throws, by the way, from some really talented quarterbacks. But for UCF to kind of stay composed, come all the way back, Bowser, their running back, had a huge game. So while UCF wasn't perfect, it still was a really good win to get over Boise State in week one. But to have those four schools join the Big 12, and at least getting a Florida team in the Big 12 as well, definitely will help for recruiting. So the Big 12, while we all thought it was going to dissipate, it might actually expand, which I think maybe is good news if you're looking for the Big 12 to be somewhat relevant. They're not involved in this alliance, which again, I say the alliance could have been a lot better, but we'll find out about that. But good news on the Big 12 front. So we'll break down week two next week. We'll try to get a student section showdown series for one of these games. And you've got some big games in week two as well. We'll go through them briefly, and then we'll do my top five next later in the week. Oregon and Ohio State, which is the big noon game on Fox. Iowa at Iowa State, which we talked about earlier. Those are the only two ranked versus ranked as of right now. I could see Utah at BYU, the Holy War, being a ranked game. I think because you got to give BYU credit for going into Vegas and beating Arizona. Otherwise, I don't really know there's another ranked versus ranked on the schedule, especially now that Washington lost to Michigan. Unless Michigan's ranked, I don't think Washington's going to be ranked at all either. And USC gets Stanford in a Pac-12 matchup. So not a lot of ranked versus ranked in week two, but still some very good matchups as well. So coming up next, we will look at the baseball pennant races. Labor Day is that final unofficial checkpoint where we look at who's actually contenders and who's fading in the distance. You're listening to Kickin' with Keeler here on Full Press Radio. We'll be back talking September pennant baseball after this. September baseball in full swing. The weather may not feel like October yet, but these games starting to mean a lot more as we get set to talk baseball here on Kickin' with Keeler on Full Press Radio. And as I mentioned throughout the show, Labor Day is that last spot where you kind of look and see, okay, is my team a contender or is my team probably just playing out the string and looking forward to the offseason in a month? But in actuality, you've got plenty of good races in baseball. More than I think people might have thought, especially when you consider there's still the contenders and the pretenders in the sport. I do think there's a lot of good in each league. So let's start in the American League East, as we do every week. We go through each division and we look at the wild cards. And I'll give you why September 19th is going to be kind of the checkpoint for some of these teams, which is actually 2 weeks from, 13 days from today. So we start the AL East. The Rays are going to win this division. Right now they're 7.5 ahead of the Yankees, 8 ahead of the Red Sox, 12 ahead of the Blue Jays. Tampa's magic number to win the AL East as you listen to this, because there are games this afternoon. We're recording this before those games start, so keep that in mind. Tampa's got a magic number of 19 to win the AL East. I know they lost to Minnesota on Sunday, but they are still very consistent. And the Yankees really disappointed. I mean, losing 2 out of 3 to the Orioles, you can understand why people are very upset with the Yankees right now. And they took a big injury on Sunday. Jonathan Loaisiga on the injured list. They already have an inconsistent role as Chapman and an inconsistent Chad Green in that bullpen. Aaron Boone made some really questionable decisions over the weekend. And to me, you look at the Yankees, and I'll say this as somebody who roots for the Yankees. They can beat anybody, and they can lose to anybody. If they make the playoffs and get out of that one-game playoff, they're the whole wild X factor, this entire thing. They're not consistent enough to me to be a World Series favorite, because they've proven they can go on hot streaks and then they go on cold streaks right after that. Joey Gallo's been, I think, a disappointment because he keeps having he's been struggling since joining the Yankees, and Aaron Boone still hits him in the number 2 spot, which is a little bit weird because I think Anthony Rizzo is a better two-hitter. And they're wasting Giancarlo Stanton's good moments. Aaron Judge is having a good year. Gary Sanchez had some good moments on Sunday. And the Yankees pitching staff, really outside of the dominance Gerrit Cole has shown, 15 strikeouts against the Angels earlier this week, they're not getting consistency from Corey Kluber, Jameson Taillon, who goes against the Blue Jays, and we'll talk about how big the series that is coming up. But they need better pitching. I mean, outside of Nestor Cortez, and I think Jordan Montgomery's actually been pretty good. He had some issues getting out of the fifth inning yesterday, or on Saturday, which is, I think, a big concern for the Yankees. But they're 7.5 back. They're not going to win the AL East. They would have to get within 3 of the Rays to have a shot, which means they'd have to make up 4.5 games over the next, what is it, about 20-plus games. I don't think they're going to do that. So Boston's in third. They took 2 out of 3 from Cleveland. They're still dealing with their own COVID issues. But the Red Sox are going to be an interesting team to watch. And you got Toronto and Baltimore, who, again, does take 2 straight from the Yankees, but they're 43-92. In the AL Central, the White Sox, magic number to clinch is 18. They got a 9.5 game lead on the Indians. Tigers are in third. Royals are in fourth. Salvador Perez continues to climb up the historic home run single season catching lead. He's at, I think he's at 42 or 43 now. Very great run Perez is on. And Minnesota is last at 59-77. In the AL West, the Astros still in control. They did lose 2 in a row to the Padres over the weekend, but still in a good position. But they're 4.5 ahead of Seattle. Mariners took advantage of playing the Diamondbacks. They've won 5 in a row. They have leapfrogged into second place in the AL West. The A's have dropped down to third. Disappointing series in Toronto. The A's starting pitching has been awful. They blew a huge lead in one of those games against the Blue Jays. Right now they are 5.5 back and fading. So keep an eye on that with Oakland. The Angels are a game under 500. And Texas is in last. In the NL East, the Braves went out west, had a little bit of issues with Colorado, which I will say this to people that look at schedules. Don't assume West Coast trips for East Coast teams are wins this time of year. Tricky things happen out west, and I always say this when you look at East teams traveling west or West teams traveling east. If you have a 7-game road trip and you go 4-3, I'm cheering that like a 6-1 homestand. It's unrealistic to expect your team to go out west and just dominate. You're just hoping they don't fall off the cliff, i.e. the Mets against the Giants and Dodgers. But the Mets are still alive. And you look at the Braves, struggle with the Dodgers, did bounce back against Colorado with a big Sunday win, but the Braves right now 2 games ahead of the Phillies, 3.5 ahead of the Mets. And this is a Met team that has thrived off their own adversity. Between Javi Baez and Francisco Lindor and Kevin Pillar essentially booing their own fans, to their former GM, Zach Scott, now on administrative leave because of a DUI charge. Whether it's just Steve Cohen tweeting things on Twitter, the Mets, I like what Gary Cohen said after a Brandon Nimmo injury over the weekend, the Mets, every time there's sunshine, there seems to be a gray cloud, but the gray cloud hasn't faded, hasn't knocked them completely out. The Mets have taken advantage of playing a bad Nationals team and a bad Marlins team, and you have to do that to stay alive. So the Mets right now 3.5 behind, then you got the Marlins and the Nationals, who could play a factor in spoiling teams rather than actually winning games, but we'll see. In the NL Central, Milwaukee with the lowest magic number, that is at 14. They lead the Reds by 11, the Cardinals by 13.5, the Cubs, despite winning 6 in a row, still in fourth place at 63-75, and the Pirates have lost 6 in a row. They're in last place and out of contention. In the NL West, really fun series this past week. The Giants playing the Cardinals. I saw Friday's game, at least the end of it, where Trey Turner makes an error that honestly it's not on him. Will Smith's not a first baseman. Needed to do a better job with receiving that throw from Turner. But the Dodgers lost that game, won Saturday's game behind Julio Urias, and then the Giants winning on Sunday. So San Francisco with a 1-game lead on the Dodgers, 14 up on San Diego. Then you got Colorado and Arizona. Giants made, I think, somewhat of a statement taking 2 out of 3. I still don't know if I trust the Giants in a 5-game series with the Dodgers, but that's still very impressive what San Francisco did, where they knew they had to win that series to somewhat make a statement. So here's where the wild card stands. We always go through your potential divisional matchups. The Rays right now easily are the one seed. They've got a 6-game lead. They're going to be the one seed regardless. The Astros and White Sox. Right now, Houston would have a 1/2-game lead on being the 2 seed, so Houston would host Chicago. The Yankees, a 1/2-game lead in the wild card on Boston. That's for the home field in the wild card game. Red Sox, 3 games up on Seattle, 4 up on Toronto, 4 up on Oakland. So that's really the cut line because I think Cleveland's out. So it's, again, 5 teams for 2 spots. Most likely the second place team in the AL wild, in the AL East is going to be one of those wild cards. So it really just comes down to, I think, 4 teams, essentially. In the NL, the Giants are the one seed as of right now, a 3.5-game lead over Milwaukee for that. The Brewers would host the Braves for that spot in the other NLDS. Dodgers are clearly the first wild card. They got a 13-game lead on the Padres, so they're going to have that spot. Padres are a 1/2-game ahead of the Reds. Reds had their issues with Detroit over the weekend, so San Diego right now with the 1/2-game lead. Phillies are 2.5 back. They've won 7 of their last 10. Cardinals are 3 back, but their schedule gets absolutely tough from here. But St. Louis, despite losing in weird fashion, a walk-off pinch-hit grand slam on Sunday, Cardinals are still somewhat alive, and the Mets are 4 back. That's where you're in a wild card right now stands. So this is what I was talking about earlier. I said keep an eye on September 19th as the swing date for some of these races. And I say that looking at the AL West teams, because I think it's not a given that the second place AL West team gets in. Seattle, here's where the Mariners are. September 19th, they end a series with Kansas City. The Mariners still have 3 of the Diamondbacks and 3 with the Royals, sandwiched by, well, actually not sandwiched by, but their other 2 series are Houston this week and a series at home with the Red Sox. After September 19th, the Mariners play the A's 7 times and the Angels 6 times. Playing the Angels 6 times is a big boost for Seattle. Now look at Oakland. The A's schedule. They have 3 with the White Sox at home this week beginning on Tuesday. The A's then get Texas, Kansas City, and the Angels. They get Texas at home, then they got to go to Kansas City and go to Los Angeles. After the 19th, the A's, I would argue, have one of the tougher schedules in baseball, or at least the American League. 4 with Seattle, 3 with Houston, 3 with Seattle, 3 with Houston. So while the Mariners are playing the Angels 6 times, the A's are playing the Astros 6 times. The only way that would benefit the A's is if the Astros don't have anything to play for other than seeding. If the division's still up for grabs, playing the Astros 6 times could doom Oakland, especially if they don't get that pitching right. Cole Irvin is starting to fade. They didn't have Frankie Montas, I think, this week. So this is an A's team that I think has to start finding it and quick, or they're going to be in big trouble. So how could September 19th be critical in the National League? Well, let's look at a team like the Cardinals. Cardinals, I mentioned, their soft stretch of the schedule is essentially over. St. Louis has the Dodgers for 4 at home, and then the Reds for 3 at home this week. Then they got to go to the Mets and host San Diego. After the 19th, they play 7 games with Milwaukee, 7 games with the Cubs. So again, there's Milwaukee right now. I think that actually might help the Cardinals with the Brewers case, because Milwaukee's going to win the Central. And with their magic number already at 14, and the Brewers essentially with a huge lead on the 2 seed, unless they can still catch the Giants, they might not have anything to play for either. So that could help St. Louis, but essentially the only team they don't play with a winning record is the Cubs, who are going to be trying to spoil their season big time. So keep an eye on that with the Cardinals. For San Diego, the Padres, after the 19th, have the Giants 6 times, the Dodgers 3 times, Atlanta 4. Really brutal stretch, and the Padres, their last, not cupcake games, but easy winnable games, are 2 with the Angels at home this week. And the other team to look at here would be the Reds. The Reds after the 19th, this is where Cincinnati is going to, if they don't make it, this is where it's a disappointment. After the 19th, the Reds play 3 with the Pirates, 4 with the Nationals, 2 with the White Sox, 3 more with the Pirates. So they still have 6 games left with the Pirates and 4 with Washington. if you count next week, they actually have 9 more games left with the Pirates. So if Cincinnati doesn't take advantage, if they're not in a great position by the 19th, they're going to still have a chance, but the Reds just have to hold water here over the next few weeks if they can, and they've got some winnable games. So Cincinnati in a great position. Teams like Oakland and Seattle going to have to hope for some help. Now, we'll get to some big series this week, and let's start with the series in the Bronx. Blue Jays at the Yankees. Toronto is in New York for 4. The Blue Jays are 4.5 behind the Yankees right now, and why this is big for Toronto. If the Blue Jays can go into New York and take 3 out of 4, and Toronto has played well in New York this season, the Blue Jays still have a bunch of games with the Orioles and a bunch of games with the Twins. And the Yankees still play Toronto 3 more times in Canada later this month. So if Toronto plays well, the Yankees all of a sudden would be in a little bit of trouble. And Toronto might be catching the Yankees at a really good time. So keep an eye on the Blue Jays here this week. They could create a big scare the way they're playing right now, winning 4 in a row, and their schedule gets so much easier down the stretch. Tampa at Boston, so another matchup of the AL East in Fenway Park. Phillies are at the Brewers. Zach Wheeler against Brandon Woodruff today. That's going to be a lot of fun. Dodgers are the Cardinals, we mentioned earlier. Seattle is at Houston. So those are some big series, at least to begin your week. And then Tuesday, you have the White Sox at the A's in Oakland, beginning a 3-game set there. Later on in the week, get to Friday. And we mentioned it. We'll touch on the series more later in the week on our Friday show. The Yankees at the Mets, 3-game series in Citi Field. And really, I think baseball, we talked about the time the schedule came out, got it right by having these two teams play in New York that weekend. So we will touch on that, of course, later in the week. But that's still a big game for playoff purposes as well. You have the Red Sox at the White Sox. Could be a potential playoff matchup there. Reds at the Cardinals in St. Louis. Padres at the Dodgers. And you have a chance here for a team like Oakland and Seattle to catch up because Oakland's playing the Rangers and the Mariners playing the Diamondbacks. The Astros are playing the Angels, but I think Houston should be fine there. So those are your matchups, or at least competitive ones, for this week. The other news in baseball, you got the Hall of Fame class on Wednesday. Midweek announcement. Unfortunately, Johnny Bench won't be there to welcome in the new inductees. He tested positive for COVID, but you will see Derek Jeter, Larry Walker, Ted Simmons, and I'm sure family for the late Marvin Miller will be there. 38 Hall of Famers will be in attendance. It's going to be a lot different, honestly. We're used to the Hall of Fame being in late July with crowds and things like that, but still with COVID in the picture. Fortunately, that will not happen. But still, finally, people like Derek Jeter getting a chance to get into the Hall of Fame. So we'll take one more break. We will come back, and we will look at some of the other sports. We'll look at golf, look at tennis, and I'm going to talk some soccer because I think Team USA, if you're thinking a World Cup qualification next year, you're not looking good right now. And listening to Kicking with Keeler on Full Press Radio, our last segment coming up after this. Wrap up Kicking with Keeler this week just like we do every other week, and that is we take a quick look at some of the other sports going on. We like to always spend more time on football and baseball, which we're going to do at least for the next couple of months, but we also like to look at some of the other events going on. There are some big events in the world of sports. Very quickly, at least on the hockey front, NHL players will be in the Olympics this year in Beijing. I love when the NHL athletes are in the Olympics. It's not the same when you have amateurs from these countries, and I think it creates more of a buzz to see your top favorite stars you watch on a daily basis put on the their country's uniforms and get a chance to play for their country. So I love that fact of the sport, so I enjoyed that news this week. But as you all know, I love the U.S. Open in tennis. And it's been a lot of drama. It's been a lot of fun, a lot of close matches, a lot of 5-set matches on the men's side, a lot of comebacks on the men's side. You've had qualifiers in the men's side make the quarterfinals. The guy from the Netherlands, I won't even I'll try to pronounce his name later, but he is in the mix with the quarters. We've seen the kid from Spain, Carlos Alcaraz, upset Stefanos Tsitsipas in a huge 5-setter this week, a 5th-set tiebreak. The women's side, the top 2 seeds are out. Ash Barty lost to American Shelby Rogers over the weekend, and Naomi Osaka, who lost to a Canadian teenager in Layla Fernandez, who is making her own run. She beat Angie Kerber on Sunday to make the quarterfinals. So making a deep run for a Canadian women in a slam. They had Bianca Andreescu as a U.S. Open champ a couple years ago. But Canada being a big major star on the tennis scene is really fun. But it was sad to hear Naomi Osaka basically say, I'm going to take a break for a while and I don't know when I'm going to play again. You could still tell that whatever she's struggling with, it's still with her. And you just hope that she gets the help she needs, and you hope that for the sport and for herself that when she wants to return, she's going to be back and better than ever. But you could tell that she's not playing the way she used to play. And we talked about that in the show, and still that the seriousness mental health needs to be taken within sports. We mentioned that ad nauseum, especially with Simone Biles in the Olympics. I'm glad the sports are putting importance on that, because it's something definitely to monitor and provide resources for these athletes. So Osaka, though, out of the draw. We mentioned the men's side with Federer and Nadal not there, and I love what Francis Tiafoe said after his fourth-round loss last night to Augier Aliassim from Canada. Said, guys feel with Federer and Nadal out, even though they have Novak Djokovic competing to have the first calendar slam by a male tennis player since Rod Laver in 1969. Guys still feel they can win. And that's why the draw is somewhat wide open outside of Djokovic, and why there have been some upsets there. You got American men actually having success at slams. We saw, I said, Francis Tiafoe beat the 5 seed, Andrei Rublev, to get to the 4th round. You've seen Riley Opelka's in the 4th round today. Jensen Brooksby in the 4th round. He's having a nice run. So there are great stories. On the women's side, Shelby Rogers. I mean, we talked about Serena and Sloane Stephens and Coco Gauff and all these great women's players, Madison Keys, but Shelby Rogers is the last one left. So that's been kind of the fun unpredictability of the U.S. Open. So scores on right now as we do the show, and as we're recording just before 1 o'clock, Alexander Zverev is playing a Sinner from Italy. Zverev's up a break in the first set. And Belinda Bencic up a set on Iga Swiatek, the former French Open champion. Bencic won the gold medal in Beijing. She's from Switzerland. She's 24, but she's a very old 24. She's been around the game for a while, but a lot of people think Bencic could win a slam. She's in the running there. Up a set on Swiatek. Right now, your other fourth round matches today, Shelby Rogers takes on the woman from Great Britain, Emma Raducanu. She's a young player that a lot of people have had high hopes for. So she's in the 4th round. She's having a great summer. Karolina Pliskova, the 4 seed, takes on Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova, the 14 seed. And a good matchup later tonight on Arthur Ashe. The 17 seed from Greece, Maria Sakkari, against the 6 seed from Canada, the former U.S. Open champion, Bianca Andreescu. That is a really fun match. I've been a big fan of Sakkari. Andreescu, of course, as we mentioned, she hasn't played in the U.S. Open since that win, but she's undefeated at the U.S. Open. So good matches in prime time. Your quarterfinal matches on Tuesday, Elena Svitolina, who I think actually could be the favorite. She, of course, is flying under the radar. She dominated Simona Halep. First time she's beat Halep at a major. She will take on, though, Fernandez, who has pulled back-to-back upsets. And then the 8 versus the 2, Barbara Krejcikova beat Garbine Muguruza in straight sets last night. Really controversial because Krejcikova took a medical timeout during a tiebreak in the 2nd set, kind of messed with Muguruza's rhythm, and then afterwards, even though Krejcikova is having trouble walking off the court by herself at the net, then Krejcikova said, sorry, Muguruza was like, that's so unprofessional. She didn't really address it post-match. She said the media can make with it what they will. But you've seen medical timeouts, and in Tsitsipas's cases, long bathroom breaks, and you wonder whether the USTA or the WTA or ATP kind of look into that, because I think that's been a big topic of conversation this week. And I think Sabalenka is flying under the radar, too. She's been dominant. Smoked Elise Mertens 6-4, 6-1 in her 4th round match. So Sabalenka against Krejcikova, we don't know what her health is. So Sabalenka, I think the winner of, if it's Svitolina gets by Fernandez, the winner of Svitolina-Sabalenka will win the women's U.S. Open this year. And on the men's side, Novak Djokovic against Jensen Brooksby tonight. I always say if you're an American men tennis player, as long as you get to facing a Djokovic or a Nadal or a Federer and you're competitive, you've had a good U.S. Open. Jensen Brooksby doesn't need to have a competitive match tonight, although I think he will have one. But I don't see anybody beating Novak Djokovic and stopping him. But Djokovic had a little bit of a tough time with Kei Nishikori. It needed four sets, but I don't see Novak getting pushed to the brink tonight by Brooksby. Matteo Berrettini, the 6th seed from Italy, takes on Oscar Otte from Germany. I think Berrettini should roll and play Djokovic and rematch the Wimbledon final in the quarters. The winner of Zverev and Sinner faces the 22-seed Riley Opelka or Lloyd Harris from South Africa. Harris has had a good summer. One of those guys on the rise as well. But Opelka, to me, great serve, and it's good to see a guy with a seed on the American side actually having success consistently. So a chance for Opelka to maybe make a semi, which would be fantastic. Haven't seen that a lot in the last 15, 20 years. Bottom half of the draw, quarterfinals on Tuesday. We mentioned Ajir Aliassime, the Canadian, the 12th seed, taking on Alcaraz, who's played back-to-back five-setters. You wonder if that'll play a factor, but can't count this kid out from Spain. He's been really good. And then Bodic van de Sanschloop, the guy from the Dutch, was up two sets on Dennis Schwartzman, then lost the next two sets, but then won 6-1 in the fifth. So Zansloop, who is the qualifier in the quarterfinals, he will have a tough task, though, against Medvedev, who has not really been tested at all. The 2-seed smoked Daniel Evans in the 4th round. So Medvedev, I think, is going to make the final. I don't see how it's not Djokovic against Medvedev playing for the U.S. Open men's title on Sunday. But we can update that more on Friday as well. On the golf side, Patrick Cantlay wins the FedEx Cup, wins the Tour Championship, squeaks one out over Jon Rahm. Remember, the staggered scoring, Cantlay started 10-under. He ended at minus 21. Jon Rahm, I think, started 6-under, actually at the minus 20. So very good performance from Rahm. But Cantlay taking home the $15 million check for winning the FedEx Cup. And he's a guy that has now gone from good golfer to elite golfer. I mean, I heard Dan Hicks and Paul Azinger talk about it on the telecast. The Tour Championship is what players are now looking at and what defines a good golfer and what defines a great golfer. And Patrick Cantlay has kind of put himself, even without a major title, into a great golfer status with that win. And then lastly for this week, let's talk about, for this show this week, let's talk about some soccer. We haven't really talked a lot of soccer on the show. I'm not the biggest expert on soccer. We didn't really get a chance to talk about Lionel Messi to PSG, Cristiano Ronaldo to Manchester United. That's the global landscape. But when I watch soccer, I like to watch the international soccer because I love the World Cup, the Euros, soccer where it's your favorite country, right? Well, the U.S. trying to qualify for the World Cup, something they didn't do 4 years ago, and there's a lot of pressure on them to actually get through this time. They made changes at coach. They brought in Greg Berhalter. And I watched a little bit of the El Salvador match early this past week, and the U.S. tied against El Salvador 0-0. Okay. And I can look at that as a disappointment, but I know people, I watched the post game, and I know people that watch soccer say, you know what, it's their first qualifying game for a lot of these players. It's on the road. There was no Christian Pulisic, the best player for the United States. To get out of there 0-0, you get a point. Not bad. But you got to beat Canada at home. And they tie Canada Sunday night 1-1 in Nashville. Maybe I'm taking the less global view. I know Canada's been better, but how are we tying Canada in soccer? I thought we had a top 10 soccer team, and then you get why the changes were made. Zach Steffen, one of their top goalies, out with back spasms, but I think he also tested positive for COVID. Gio Reyna was out with a hamstring injury. He's one of their better players. They did get Pulisic back. But here's where, again, we have an issue with COVID, but a different issue. Weston McKennie, who is supposed to be one of their better players, they're one of their more crucial players to the success of the team, was suspended due to violation of protocols. We don't know what he did, but this isn't the first time McKennie did this. Back in April, he was suspended by his club team, Juventus, plays for the team out in Italy. He hosted a party with teammates and 20 other people. So this tells me Weston McKennie doesn't care or he has no discipline whatsoever to be a leader on this team. If that's a guy that you're relying on to be a leader, then this team isn't making the World Cup. These guys got to kick it into high gear. They got a tough match coming up with Honduras later this week. And if they don't win that match, remember, they still haven't played Mexico yet. This team's in trouble. And for a nation in the United States that loves watching soccer, but it's really weird because from a soccer perspective, we all love watching the Premier League, and people have always said it, Ricky, if you want to get into soccer, you got to pick a Premier League team, and I've just never gotten into doing that or picking an international club team because I do like MLS. I do watch some of it. I have friends in MLS. But if the U.S. were to miss the World Cup again, the damage it could do to the sport here is huge. They cannot afford to miss the World Cup again and essentially waste another 4 years of Pulisic. Again, I'm not the biggest soccer expert, but I know when you're tying El Salvador and you're tying Canada, it's not good enough. You don't have to dominate the sport, but you got to at least be good. And they're not good right now. A lot of questions. And I'm be looking forward. Somebody that I know who I work with wants me to talk soccer. I'm going to give it to him later today when I see him. Like, why are we tying Canada? Why are we not beating teams that we should be beating? Maybe I have a bigger expectation than you do of USA soccer, but it's really tough to watch right now. So again, this is our first show this week. Our next show will be Friday. You will get my week one word association. You will get my Cowboys Bucks recap. You will get my top five games to watch in the Flip the Channel game of the week. You will get college football top five games to watch in week two. Maybe you'll get a student section showdown. We'll try to work on that. And we'll have, of course, another segment, a special segment, reflecting on 20 years since 9/11. So much to get into on Friday that we're going to do two shows to you this week. And we're maybe going to try to do two shows during the season, too. Maybe we'll do a wrap-up show on Monday for the football, and then we'll do a preview show later in the week. So maybe we'll do two shows with that as well. I want to remind you can tweet us on Twitter, @RickNader5, tweet me, @RickNader555, tweet us on Twitter, @FP_coverage, @FullPressRadio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you get your podcast, just search Kicking with Keeler. Chances are you will find it. And I want to hear from you. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. What's your word association for your favorite team's game? What's your Flip the Channel game of the week? Again, it's rickjkeeler@gmail.com. Be sure to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It is free. All of our articles, podcasts, live shows, everything is there. So be sure to check that out. You can check some of my work over at Pinch Hit Prospects. I host From the Backfield to the Bronx podcast. Only 2 weeks left in the minor league season for the Yankees affiliates. They had one affiliate score 14 runs in the ninth inning yesterday, the High A Hudson Valley Renegades. I'm sure touch on that, and hopefully if we do a podcast this week. And you can catch my work over at Barrett Sports Media. Some of my articles I did this week. One was about Steve Levy and Brian Griese on the Dave Pasch podcast talking about how year one of Monday Night Football went. And the other article I did was, I believe, Michael Irvin talking about his first show with Stephen A., which was today. So it was a couple articles I did over there. I should be back with an article, if not tomorrow, probably Wednesday will be the next one I do. So thanks all for tuning in. Thanks for kicking it with me, Ricky Keeler, on your Labor Day. Have a great rest of your week. Enjoy Cowboys Bucks Thursday night. Enjoy Louisville against Ole Miss tonight. Enjoy the U.S. Open. And I will see you back here on Friday to look ahead to college football and NFL football week one. It is finally here. We get to actually talk some games. And that should be a lot of fun. Thanks again. And I'll see you next time.